Today is Tuesday, February 27th, 2007. My name is Sandy Fahler, and I am an interviewer with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Department. Today, I am interviewing Professor Emerita Jane Wojcik of the Department of Nutritional Sciences in the UW-Madison College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. Dr. Wojcik held a joint appointment in UW-Madison and UW Extension. She retired in 1996 after 25 years of service. Good morning.
Good morning, Sandy.
We're going to start this interview by asking you about your early life, where and when you were born, if you talk about your family, where you went to school, elementary and high school, if there were any people in your early life that influenced you on your career path.
Yes, well, I went to school in a little town in Massachusetts called Walpole, Massachusetts. I went to a public grade school and public high school, and it was really a very small town, and I thrived there. My family was very supportive of education. Both my parents had college degrees. We had a lot of books in our home, and it was always assumed I would go to college. That was never in question. It was also obvious to me from an early age that I would have to help support my way through college because we had modest means, but we were very happy, and I would say we had a good middle class life. My parents were a little uncertain as to the level of my ability because in the little town it would be hard to evaluate it. I did well, but you know, what was my competition? So they took me to Boston University to be tested, which was the nearest big town. And Boston University, after doing a bunch of achievement tests in that era, concluded that I was gifted in science, but that since I was female, probably a logical place for me to end up would be dietetics. Although if I were male, they would have suggested I go into chemistry, which I thought was really interesting with what happened in the rest of my life, because that was the first and last for many years I thought about nutrition as a possible career. My parents did this evaluation partly because they didn't know how successful I would be with the SATs. There was no such thing as PSATs. In fact, I'm not even sure there were SATs in that era, and they didn't know how I'd be evaluated for college admission. I was admitted, though, to Oberlin College.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to back up.
Okay.
Just a little bit. Did you have any brothers and sisters?
I had one sister, 3 years younger.
Okay.
So I was an older child and sort of set the stage.
Uh-huh. And what did your parents do?
My mother was a very active volunteer and also did substitute teaching. And for a while, she sold real estate to supplement the income of my father, who was a mid-management person in a big hospital supply company. Mm-hmm. And his career was never that important to him. His family life was probably more important. They were very active in the church, and they were active in environmental causes, and my father was on the library board, and mm-hmm. they were good citizens in the town. My mother was active in League of Women Voters, and
so they were very good mentors then to you,
right,
and your sister.
Right. I think they instilled a sense of service mm-hmm. in both of us.
Mm-hmm. And so then you went to Oberlin College. How did that decision come about?
There were a number of things. I think my parents felt I should go to the best school I could go to. I mean, and so we'd find a way to pay for it. Which I ended up working my way a lot of the way through college. But we picked a school that didn't have sororities or fraternities. They wanted it to be not a place where the haves and have-nots were obvious. Hmm. Oberlin was the first college to admit blacks. It was coeducational. It was small. It placed a high priority on academics. And I think my mother and father thought that that would be a really good place for me.
And you agreed.
And I agreed. Mm-hmm. I mean, my mother went to Wellesley College, and she would have been happy if I'd gone to Wellesley College. But I wanted to do something different. I liked the idea of a coeducational school. Mm-hmm. and getting away from the immediate area of New England, learning about some other part of the country. So at that point, it was considered I was going west to Ohio. And it did seem like a long way away. It was a long bus ride for me because I couldn't afford to fly or take more expensive transportation.
Now, what year was that you went to Oberlin?
I went to Oberlin in 1950.
Okay. And talk about your experience there. Was it what you expected?
It was daunting for me. There were a lot of really smart people there. And I felt it was academically challenging. I got B's and C's. I certainly didn't think I was the smartest person around, I'll tell you, which was different from high school. Mm-hmm. Some of the ambience of Oberlin I loved. I loved the fact that people really cared about studying and studied all the time. Football was nothing. I mean, Saturday you went to the library, and you got free tickets to the football game, but nobody went. It was a Division III school, so, the academics, they had good lacrosse and some of the more offbeat sports. Mm-hmm. But I guess my biggest outside activity, outside of trying to keep ahead of my studies, was I was in a co-op.
Oh.
And we saved half of our money on our room and board through hiring a cook and having the cook make the food in a private house which we rented. And then mm-hmm. the women lived in the house and the men came and ate there.
Hmm.
And so that was very, we worked maybe the equivalent of 10 hours a week, and we got substantial savings.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I think that I liked about Oberlin was, as I said, it was all business, the small classes, the faculty really cared about the students. The social rules were very strict. I had to be in my college room at 8:30. Unless I stayed out until 10 o'clock at a library pass. That was the only. And then Saturday nights you could stay out until midnight. But there were no cars, so you're really on this little island in Ohio at this college.
Now, what kind of work did you do while you were in college?
I majored in psychology at Oberlin. And one of the things that I remember is my professor said, "Now, I'm not recommending that you go on for a PhD. I think partly some of that was grades. But also, he felt that I should not go for a PhD unless I were going to remain single. Because he just had too much experience, or he'd heard about women who had sort of wasted a spot in graduate school, quote unquote, and then gotten married and not had a full career. So the atmosphere is very different than it is now. And I think I picked psychology, maybe harking back to that advice from the Boston University people, don't go into hard science, that's a men's field. There was very definitely a sex, gender-oriented majors. But we only had 10 or 12 majors of psychology at Oberlin.
Hmm.
Interestingly enough, one of my classmates from Oberlin, who's a psychology major, lives in Madison, which is a small world.
Yeah.
But, it was good for me because it had a lot of science as a part of it. I was more interested in physiological psychology, and I was interested in appetite even then. And
mm-hmm.
So it was a good foundation.
What about female faculty? Were there any faculty that you can remember that were positive influences?
I don't remember any female faculty. There might have been some, but I don't think there were very many at all.
Huh.
And I know that there were some wives of male faculty who just languished. I mean, there was nothing for them to do there.
Hmm.
So I think there were female English faculty and maybe female art history faculty, and I'm sure female music. Oberlin is a very good music school, and there were a lot of music female faculty. But in the sciences, I don't remember any.
Hmm. So here you had this degree then in psychology.
Right.
Did you have any idea what you were going to do with it?
Well, I went back to Boston after I graduated. I actually spent an extra year at Oberlin doing some graduate work in psychology, but never got a master's degree. I was sort of hanging around because I had some friends there. I wasn't real directed, and I was not getting good signals that I should go on for a PhD. So I went back to Boston And I got a job in a psychology laboratory at Boston University.
Oh.
And worked, actually I worked with some, while I was in Boston and subsequently when I was in Providence for a little while, I worked with some really eminent psychologists, experimental and social psychologists, and sort of got in a lab and really got involved in some work. But I decided it after I'd done that for a little while that I really didn't care for the type of research I was doing. I was involved in, it was involved in seeing if dental caries were a result of stressed animals. And I felt, you know, this was before all of the animal rights and animal protections, and I really felt there was something wrong with torturing these animals, which essentially is what we were doing, to see if they got dental caries. So what I did was to take a leave from school, and I worked in a department store as a trainee to be a, you know, go into management in retailing.
And that was in Boston also?
In Boston at Filene's, which is a pretty famous department store. And they had a very well-known training program for management. And I sometimes say that was probably some of the best education I ever got.
Uh-huh.
Learning about customer satisfaction, learning how to merchandise, learning how to purchase materials and sell them to the public. It was fascinating.
And how long did you do that?
Well, I did that for maybe 2 or 3 years, and then I met my husband, who my husband to be, who was an Oberlin graduate who I didn't know at Oberlin, but we met through mutual Oberlin friends in Boston. And he was finishing up his PhD in mathematics at Brown, and he was on leave in Boston for a year because his professor had a sabbatical at Harvard and brought Mike along.
Ah.
So it's just sort of weird. He was there and we had mutual friends and we met, and after a year we were married and I moved to Providence.
Okay. And then what did you do?
Well, I got a job in the psychology labs at Providence working with a student of Harlow's, as a matter of fact, who's a famous psychologist from Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
and also a student of Skinner's, who is a famous psychologist from Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really worked with these second generation, really famous psychologists doing work with animals, pigeons and monkeys. And I got pregnant fairly soon after we were married, and so about a year and 2 months after we were married, we had our first child in Providence, and I worked carrying monkey cages until the day I had my baby.
Oh,
I mean,
my.
You know, there was no parental leave or anything ahead of time.
Sure.
And so I, you know, and my husband was earning not very much as a, he was all but degree for a while, and he had an instructorship. And then he got a job at Dartmouth. So we went to Hanover, New Hampshire.
Position?
He was a research associate, I think, or research instructor.
Mm-hmm.
It was a terminal 2-year position at Dartmouth.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to Dartmouth. I had one child in Providence in 1962. I had my second child in Dartmouth in 1963. And then he got a job at Wisconsin. And I came here and had my third child in 1964. So you can kind of imagine, I'd had 3 children in 3 years in 3 different states. I'd worked until the day I had my first child. I had not subsequently worked. And when I came to Wisconsin and had my third child and was told, don't have it on a Saturday because that's a football game and we'll never be able to get you to the hospital on time, I was beginning to think I'd come to really a weird place. It was so different. There were more faculty here than students of any place I'd ever been before. It just seemed huge to me. And we lived on the south side of Madison, a place called Fontaine Circle, which became Somerset.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Okay.
But when we moved here, it was like the fanciest place you could move into with 3 bedrooms. It was too isolated for me, and a year after we got here, we moved to University Houses, where we lived very happily for about 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I just happened to go to a sort of a social event for faculty wives where it was, I remember well, it was Marion Thompson and Connie Trinan, who were very, and Kay Clarenbeck, had this little group in Extension where they were promoting women's education. And they sort of said something along the lines of, well, you know, you shouldn't be sitting home. I mean, to the assembled group.
Sure.
There are lots of things you can do. You can continue your education. And with me, with three children under three at home, that sounded really attractive. So I thought, well, that's a good idea. I'm going to try to look into that. So when I went and started doing some investigation about what my background was and what I could possibly do, mm-hmm. it was pretty clear psychology was not going to be a good target for me with my grades and my three children under three, and I was not what you would regard as a good risk. But maybe the old time home economics might mm-hmm. be more interested. They'd be more hospitable.
I see.
So I looked into the School of Home Economics, and at that time they had four departments there. They had food and nutrition, child development, family resource management, and textiles and clothing. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I got a D in sewing in seventh grade. I better not do that. I certainly didn't want child development. I had plenty of that at home with nobody else helping me with that. I thought, as a matter of fact, I could bring my three children to the child development house and live there, and the people would get some really good experience. Students could get some really good experience, but nobody was interested in my doing that. And I thought, I hate budgeting, and I've always had to worry about money my whole life. I don't want to do that. So that left food and nutrition. So I knocked on the door of the chair of the food and nutrition department. My name is Jane Wojcik. I'm interested in graduate work. You know, what would be my options for starting a program in your department? And I'll never forget, she said to me, well, would you be interested in food or nutrition? And I said, what's the difference? That was not an auspicious start.
No.
And so then she said, well, food is before you eat it, nutrition is after you eat it. I said, well, in that event, I think I'd rather study nutrition. So, and it did go with some of my physiological psychology coursework. So I was about the worst risk I think that she'd ever encountered. I mean, you know, I had these family obligations, and I had not a good grade record, and I hadn't had any of the prerequisite courses you needed to get into the graduate program. I mean, now we would look at somebody like me and we would say, forget it, you know. But she must have seen something. And she said, well, you know, you have to take organic chemistry and you have to take physiology. And sort of, you can take these things as a special student, and then we'll see. Mm-hmm. So I thought, special student, that sounds pretty good. Like I'm special, right? Yeah,
right.
So I started taking these courses, and I just loved them. And I did very well. I mean, I was like off the charts. The undergraduates hated me because I was bringing up the grade, the curve and all this. But I just loved them. And somehow I found time. And I also felt I shouldn't be taking from the family income to do this. So I got a part-time job, which then paid for the babysitting that I needed. And there was no daycare or anything like that. Yeah. I had to find somebody who would come into the house. And so I paid for that, plus I paid for my tuition.
What was your job?
I worked in Richard Steem's lab. Now, Dick Steem is an old Madison, he's from an old Madison family. He now is at UCLA, but he was a pretty up-and-coming immunologist in the medical school. Mm-hmm. And he taught me laboratory techniques, which was extremely helpful mm-hmm. when I started taking biochemistry. I took a biochem lab where I learned a lot of the techniques from my mentor, Dick Steem. Mm-hmm. And I did immunology research for him, just very technician-like level. But it was very helpful, and he was very kind and helpful to me. And we got to be friends with the Steems. Judy, his wife, just got a Distinguished Alumni Award from the university, and she's been in administration at Florida International University. And mm-hmm. so they've been very helpful, and I've known them for 50 years, really. Mm-hmm. Judy Steem went to college with my husband at Oberlin. It's
another one of those
weird circles. So. Anyway, I did my graduate program. I after the first year, they gave me a traineeship because of my success. And so I didn't have to work quite so hard. I could just focus on my research. I worked with a professor who had the traineeship. I mean, there was no, I didn't cherry pick among the professors.
Yeah, right, right.
And he was sort of like almost a peer. We were about the same age, and he was a new PhD. And I did a very biochemical, very technical thesis, which had absolutely nothing to do with anything I did after. But it was fine, you know, people thought. And I always had the attitude of, I'm only going to do this as long as I'm enjoying it. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to stress out over this. I've got these other responsibilities, these three children, you know. And my husband was very helpful and very supportive.
That's
and
good.
Yeah, it was essential.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, kept on going. And in 5 years, I had a PhD. I did a master's degree and a PhD.
That's phenomenal when you think about it. Well, I mean,
yeah.
I'm sure you realize it.
Well, it was, you know, and I think the reason I could do it was because there was not a lot of pressure. It was, I loved the yeah. work. And, you know, I just sort of got through all these hurdles that people have a lot of, sometimes people have a lot of problems with, like my prelims and my qual. I mean, I was good at it and I mm-hmm. liked doing it. And I figured, if this doesn't work out, I can always get a job. I mean, I'm not going to worry about not, it's not going to be a disgrace to me if I don't finish this degree.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I got through, and I don't know if you want to go into the next part.
Well, I do. So what did you do with this
Well, I have this
degree.
PhD, mm-hmm. and what do you do with a PhD in this really biochemical area of nutrition? And it was sort of in an era where spousal hires were not, I mean, they didn't exist at
what
that point.
What year was this when you got
1971.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, I had really good friends in the math department where the wife had to remain a lecturer, even though she was a world-renowned mathematician, because her husband was on the faculty and they couldn't have two in the same department. That later was corrected. But the pressure was not having two faculty members in the same family, and people would say things almost like, well, you know, you've got one job, why do you need two? I mean, it was almost that attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And so the climate was not real good toward getting a faculty position. Plus, getting a faculty position here was, you know, they don't like you to go to have a faculty position where you got your degree. And I had no postdoc because, of course, I was here,
right.
You know. So I would say my options were limited, and my advisor always assumed I'd go into industry. You know, I'd get a job like with Oscar Mayer or somebody,
mm-hmm.
do some research lab work with industry. But I heard about this job as extension connection. It was a joint position with a department with extension. And I thought, well, you know, I like working with people and I'm service oriented. And I really do believe that the state of Wisconsin people should get the benefits of the mm-hmm. University of Wisconsin. And this is a way of being able to do that. And so I applied for that job. And the interviews were really funny because the department always viewed this as almost a giveaway. I mean, they didn't have to put much money into it, and they were getting a position. And they could probably put this person to work for them.
And by department, you mean the department
nutritional,
yeah, where you got your PhD.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And they knew me. I was a known quantity. I'd done
right.
well. They liked me. And they didn't have to worry about me being a big research hotshot because that wasn't the job description,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so the fact that I hadn't learned some new biochemical technique from somebody in another university in a postdoc wasn't as important. It was probably more important that I knew the faculty, I could ask them for help if I didn't know the answers to questions I might get asked
mm-hmm.
by somebody out in the state. And, you know, they felt I could make that interface pretty successfully. And the chair at that time was Alf Harper, who was very supportive of this enterprise. He didn't think it was as important as doing biochemistry work.
Uh-huh.
But he thought it was of value.
Mm-hmm.
And that I would probably be a pretty good person to do it. When I went to interview the extension people, who after all were paying 80% of my salary, The first thing they said to me was, have you ever been in 4-H? No. What do you know about Extension Homemakers? What are they? I mean, you know, I hadn't done my homework. I hadn't had a lot of time. I'd gotten my degree like the week before. I was pretty rushed.
Right.
And so, or I might have even been interviewing when I was finishing up. I forget. But anyway, somehow they decided to give me the job. The department was really pushing for me to get the job. And so I got the job. And like a week later, they expected me to go to Janesville and judge a foods contest for the 4-H people down there. And I didn't have a clue. I mean, I didn't know what a tunnel in a muffin was, which they were supposed to avoid if they had a good muffin. I didn't know what the four food groups were. I mean, you know, I'd learned some very esoteric little biochemical fact about a protozoan.
Sure.
As my PhD thesis. So it's kind of funny, you know, I had to think on my feet pretty hard. And I remembered my mother telling me when she was substitute teaching physics in high school, she'd always find the brightest kid and have them teach the class without them knowing it. And so I was using that technique, who is the brightest looking kid here? I would say to them, well, what do you think the four food groups are? And then watch the reaction of the others. And if they thought it was a good answer, I would say, that's very good, you know. So I caught on. I mean, I like the philosophy of extension. Uh-huh. I didn't always think it was executed the way I would execute it. And I was at a pretty low level. Uh-huh. I was just learning. I had some really almost tyrannical mentors in extension who were going to teach me how to do it right. And there were certain things that it had always been done this way. And
I see.
The style then was for people to go out in the state and give lectures, as opposed to empower the staff that are already out there and sure. who know their community and maybe don't have the technical background you have, but should be doing the teaching because mm-hmm. they're the ones that are going to be there after you come back to Madison.
Right, right.
So, you know, and there was a lot of dependence on these Extension Homemaker clubs. They were their support groups of these women Extension agents. And there was a reluctance to spend time with others than those women clubs. And it was at an era where we were discovering the diversity of Wisconsin, the need to work with people that have low income, the need to work with people of color mm-hmm. when we could find some. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I think that change was coming hard to some of those people, and we were caught up in that. And at that point in my life, I didn't have to worry too much about it. Later, I did, which was problematic. But I enjoyed it mm-hmm. most of the time. Mm-hmm. The thing that I think was most stressful in those early years of being a faculty member, aside from just the whole assistant professor thing, was and not quite knowing how I'd be evaluated, because after all, my job was 80%.
Yeah.
The things that aren't rewarded for in tenure. Yeah. I was given a teaching assignment of teaching an introductory nutrition class, and it was on the radio. It was on WHA, live. So I'd never taught at all as a graduate student. At that time, they didn't have a requirement that graduate students do teaching. And my first teaching assignment, I'm teaching to the state. I think they thought that was sort of appropriate, having the extension position. But meanwhile, there are undergraduates out there who are getting credit for this course, and it's supposed to be, you know, I'm supposed to be getting some content across.
Uh-huh.
And it has to be oral.
True. Yeah.
Because they don't have, you know, there was no technology to have project slides or anything like
sure.
that.
Sure.
I had a very understanding, helpful colleague who taught half the lectures, and I taught half the lectures. And at the end of the class, we did evaluations, and the students said, you know, you'd be better if you didn't read your lectures. And I didn't have the heart to tell them. I was so scared stiff. That was the only way I dared do it and be sure that I would be able to. And I just spent hours and hours and hours on that, getting that ready.
Yeah.
So, you know, we had other experiences, like in extension at that time, everybody was expected to do what was called one-minute tapes. So we would all have to go down, I think, every month or every other month and have 6 one-minute tapes that were supposed to instruct the public about some nutrition fact, in my case. And they had to be 1 minute, and we had to read them into a tape recorder, just like I'm doing now. Uh-huh. And it had to be really carefully timed. And I'll never forget the lady who helped with that. It was Betty Pope, now Betty Zorb at that time, who was in the Ag Journalism Department. And she would patiently help me read through these 1 minute tapes. And I was so envious of some of my colleagues who could, on their way down there, figure, oh, I'll talk about mercury today and just come up with a 1 minute tape, you know, in their heads. And I would always have to laboriously write out every word and count the words and figure out when I was going to take a breath. And it was really hard for me to do that. But, you know, I'd say I loved it and I was successful and I had a really supportive. Alf Harper was department chair all those years. And he, you know, he hired me. He thought I was probably a good choice for the position. I was doing okay in my duties in the department with the teaching. And I actually started a new course called Nutrition Today, which eventually built up to over 1,000 students a semester.
Wow.
Because I thought that there were people out there who hadn't had chemistry who'd like to learn about nutrition. Mm-hmm. And that became one of the most popular courses in the university. Mm-hmm. And I had, wrote some articles about teaching nutrition and got noticed by USDA, who supports the extension position. And things were really going well, and I got promoted to associate professor.
Well, now, you say that sort of matter of fact, but how was that process since there?
Well, in that time, it wasn't nearly as stressful as it is now. If your department chair wanted you to be promoted, and you had, and my job description was so strange, mm-hmm. that nobody could really evaluate it very well, mm-hmm. except, and they deferred to him.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, it was sort of like, trust me, she's doing good work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I had some publications, not as many as somebody who's full-time resident staff would do, and I'd certainly done a lot of teaching. Mm-hmm. And I had good evaluations from the service part of my record. Mm-hmm. And, pretty much they wrote it. I mean, I didn't even have to put together this big document people do now. Mm-hmm. And it went through. And fortunately for me, it went through on the Madison campus. It was not a separate. Some people earlier were being evaluated by extension committees, which might have been fairer for extension,
mm-hmm.
but which didn't have the currency,
sure.
that the Madison stamp of approval through the divisional committees in Madison had. And later on, there were some difficulties with that, which I actually got involved in, but with for other people.
Mm-hmm.
But I went through the Madison campus.
Mm-hmm.
And then shortly after I was made associate professor, or not too long after I was made associate professor, I was approached by people from Washington and asked if I would be willing to come in and work there in a leadership position in the extension nutrition area in USDA.
Oh.
So I went in there and I worked for 2.5 years, commuting to Washington. I would leave on Sunday and come back Thursday night, and my poor family survived.
How old were your children?
I was just thinking about that. They were in high school.
Uh-huh.
And my husband was very helpful again. I mean, he just sort of came through. And there are a lot of jokes about what they ate when I was out of town. And, I would see them, and then I would come home, and I still had some graduate students here and some responsibilities here. So I would come home, and on Friday I would answer my mail. On Saturday I would do the laundry for the household, and Sunday I would, you know, do some cooking, and then I'd get on the plane Sunday afternoon and go to Washington. I really never worked so hard in my life, and that was very stressful in Washington. I mean, that was a pressure cooker time.
What were your responsibilities?
I was in charge of the nutrition programs in Extension, which meant all of the low-income nutrition program, which at that point was a $50 million program. It was all pass-through money, mm-hmm. but I had to be sure the reporting was done and the policies were set. And, so I was sort of elevated to a dean-level position,
yeah.
from an associate professor. And I had supervisory responsibilities, which were tough because I'm very task-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And the people there were really laid back. And, you know, they just didn't countenance having somebody come in from the Midwest of all places telling them what to do, you know. But I had a lot of support at the outset. And then some of my support vanished when the extension director position was changed. But I learned some important lessons about human resources, mm-hmm. working with people. And I mean, I did a incredible job. I made some good changes in there. But 2.5 years was a little longer than anybody had planned for it to go on, including me. Mm-hmm. And it was always supposed to be temporary. And I was not interested in a permanent position in Washington. I mean, I think now a lot of people that had my background and sort of start would be either divorced or having separate careers from their husbands, mm-hmm. because they just would have figured, you know, the options are much better if you looked broader.
Yeah.
But my philosophy was to stay in Madison. I like Madison. Mm-hmm. I like my husband. He was being very good to me, mm-hmm. and we had a good relationship, and the children were obviously keeping me here, and so I never really considered these things very seriously. I was also at that point courted by Cornell, and which was probably the number one department, at least doing the kinds of things I was interested in the country. And mm-hmm. you know, I just really, I made a joke. I said, "Well, when you get the national championship in hockey, I'll consider it, but not before." You know, but anyway, it was just. I think I made a good choice to mm-hmm. stay here.
Mm-hmm. And that was your position throughout your career here at Wisconsin, the dual position between?
Yes, I've always had, I mean, there have been these permutations. I think one of the things that has kept life interesting is I have had these other experiences. I never had a sabbatical, but these were kind of like sabbaticals. Mm-hmm. Sabbaticals didn't really start becoming commonly given until I was near the end of my career. I mean, they're much more common now. But I kind of figured I had one without asking for it. Mm-hmm. Essentially, they gave me leave. They didn't give me money, but I always got, when I was in USD, I was getting a lot more money.
Okay.
They really enhanced my salary, and they paid all my expenses, all my travel expenses. So we were able to put some money away for college for our kids mm-hmm. with that offer.
So then you came back after 2.5 years. Was it hard to come back?
Well, that I think it was a little bit, because I'd really seen the big time, and mm-hmm. I was coming back to a fairly low-level position. And at that point, I'd really become intrigued by extension. I mean, I'd seen it from the federal level, how different universities managed extension. And I also knew the Madison, you know, the UW model. And I thought, you know, maybe I can make a contribution here.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a job for 1 year. I mean, I kept my title all throughout all of this, mm-hmm. as what was called the district program leader. And a district program leader acts as sort of the human resources that they work with are the county agents in one part of the state. Okay. So I worked with the broad home economics extension program in the South Central District. And so
which
I really
is part of
Madison, mm-hmm. right? So it kept me closer to home, which I liked.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I worked as a part of a team. There was somebody who worked with the youth person. There was somebody who worked with the home economist. There was somebody who worked with the agriculture agents. And then there was the person who was in charge of the team, who was called the district director, and that was a full-time extension position. And they worked with the county committees to make sure they liked the people and would hire new people when the ones left. And you know, mm-hmm. keep everything happy as mm-hmm. far as the relationship between extension and the counties was concerned, because these positions are paid from three sources of funds, federal, state, and local.
Okay.
And the local people put up quite a bit of money, and they have to be kept feeling happy about
sure.
what these people are doing. Mm-hmm. And yet the university has certain standards they want to put on these people. And they might not always be completely lined up.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. you're trying to justify, you know, the home economist shouldn't be making coffee for the ag, you know, the nice. Ag committee, but maybe they should be out teaching something important, you know, mm-hmm. kind of thing. So anyway, I worked in that kind of personnel area for a year. And then after that, I applied for...
Well, now, was that a success as far as you were concerned?
Well, I think it's a very valuable experience. I mean, it's the only experience that I had working closely with county-level people. Before, it was always a case of I was a resource for them, but I had no responsibility for ensuring... Well, I mean, I had some responsibility for ensuring their success, but in this position, I was looking at the whole job and, you know, the demands on them and how they could put them together. It was more personnel related. So then, after that, I applied for and got a job as state program leader. Now, that was really political. I mean, that job became very sensitive because I was now in charge of all of the home economists in the state. And also the specialists on the Madison campus who worked in the area. So I sort of had gone to the top of my job. And I did really well with the specialists. I understood their situations. I mean, I could defend them in departments and tell the departments how important it was they were doing their work and justify it. I had less success with the county staff statewide. Because of all the pressures that were on them, and it was a really hard time, we were cutting positions. So, you know, anything, any cuts, who gets blamed? Even though I had nothing to do with, you know, I had nothing to do with the budget, except to maybe try to justify more money for our program. But so anyway, that was hard, and I eventually, that's the only thing I did at Madison in my career where I felt I really did not succeed, and they relieved me after... I did it for 4 years.
Oh, boy.
Part of it was I was hired by one person, and that person was taken out of his position.
Now, who did you report to?
The director of extension. So it's through the extension part of my appointment.
Okay.
And the department kept giving me an office, and it was okay if I showed up every once in a while. And during that period, I really did virtually nothing for the department. Except be a name on their roster. I mean, I wasn't doing any teaching. It was definitely a full-time position. You know, it was sad when I lost the job because I put a lot into it and I'd always been successful at anything I'd done. And that was really a time when I had to think about, well, now what do I do? Because I kind of burned bridges with my nutrition connections. And I came back to the department. People were very gracious. I said, we're happy to see you back. We know you can do good things. And I decided that if I couldn't give that kind of service to Extension successfully, I would try to give service back to the Madison campus.
Okay.
And I had been on the athletic board, which was sort of a fluke that I got appointed to the athletic board. But I was on the athletic board for 9 years throughout this whole period. I started my last year in Washington on the athletic board.
Now, how did you get on when you said it was sort of a fluke?
Well, you know, it's funny because since, well, I don't know all of it. I know that the secretary of the faculty, who at that time was Peter Bunn, called up me at home on a weekend, which was the only time he could reach me. And he said, my name is Peter Bunn. I barely knew him. He said, I'm interested in seeing if you would be willing to be on the athletic board. And I said, well, I can't be on the athletic board. I'm working in Washington. And he said, well, you know, it's really unusual for people to say no to being asked to being on the athletic board. Later, I found out people practically kill to get on the athletic board. And I said, well, you know, I'm sorry, but I don't see how I can do it. And I, you know, I'm not one who's known for saying no. So he said, well, you know, let's think about this a little bit. How long are you going to be working in Washington? Well, I knew my appointment was going to end within a few months. And I said, he said, what I'm offering you is for your career time, the rest of your career at Madison. They've changed, but at that point, when you got on the athletic board, it was you didn't stop until you retired. So I said, he said, you know, think about the long term. You're going to be coming back here. This would be an interesting thing to do. And I said, well, when does it meet? And he said, Fridays. Well, that was the one day I was here, you know. I said, well, I guess I could do it. So I was on until Donna Shalala came and decided she didn't like this
idea of having lifetime terms on the athletic board, she wanted to turn it over, which just makes sense.
Uh-huh.
So uh-huh. I stopped being on the athletic board at that point. But it was a way for me to get into an aspect of university administration,
sure.
which sort of increased my taste for maybe doing some other things in governance, mm-hmm. and which I subsequently did.
Well, what happened? What are some of the issues that the board took up that you know were the more interesting ones while you were a member?
Well, Title IX was very big. I mean, that was the time when the university was sort of knew it had to increase opportunities for women's sports, and so they did an evaluation of what would be an appropriate way to expand women's sports and what should be the targets according to what women are interested. You know, it couldn't just be numbers of people in each gender because not so many women go out for sports. So mm-hmm. they had to look at interest as well as the gender split. And budgets were very tight then because football was definitely not successful. It was during the Don Morton time. And it was really not good at all, not doing well at all. And as neither was basketball. So the main income producing sports weren't producing income the way they hopefully would in the future and did in the future. So, you know, money was a major issue. And so we cut out some sports, which was very harmful and hurtful for people, like men's baseball mm-hmm. and men's gymnastics. We started off cutting badminton, which was not too hard to do. But then I never would have thought I'd see the day when we added women's hockey. I mean, that happened after I left.
Yeah.
And that was just such a nice thing to be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
So those were big ones. And then I always worked with the academic part. I mean, I worked on the eligibility committee. Mm-hmm. And toward the end, I was a Big Ten faculty representative, which was fun because it meant that I went to the Big Ten meetings and also went to the Rose Bowl. You asked if there were other women involved in the Big Ten. Every campus had to have a woman and a man.
Oh, okay.
So that was, I mean, mm-hmm. otherwise I probably wouldn't have been able mm-hmm. to do it. I was like the senior woman on the athletic board at that point, so mm-hmm. I got to do that.
So then that got you interested in other university
right.
committees. And
right, and I thought, well, you know, what could I do? So I thought several were of particular interest. The Biological Sciences Divisional Committee was of interest to me because that was where people like me would come up for tenure. And I could see that the timing was, you know, it was getting much harder for women who had sort of odd career paths or odd assignments or had a big outreach responsibility, to be specific, mm-hmm. to be successfully promoted. And I also didn't like the idea that people were having so much stress. I mean, there was so much stress involved. And so I thought, well, maybe I can help with that. So I got elected to the divisional committee. I also ran for and was elected to the university committee.
Oh.
And I was on that for 3 years.
Oh, could you talk about that a little bit? Were there some issues there that you were particularly stressful or interesting?
Well, we did the consensual relations policy, which is controversial. And I was wondering about it because I think, I don't know if it's been revised, and I should check that because we occasionally get issues like that come to the ombuds, which is something I do now. We also worked on...
I'm going to ask you to back. Could
sure.
you talk a little bit about that, about the consensual relations policy?
Well, you know, the issue was how do you protect when there's a power differential? How do you write a policy that protects the person that's at the lower level of power and not be too intrusive? You know, into people's lives. I mean, everybody knows that professors and graduate students sometimes get together. And so how do you,
And so the way the policy is written, you have to serve notice. You have to give notice. And so where there are situations where decisions are made based on, you know, somebody has a power position, they are taken, the responsibility for that individual is taken away from them.
I see.
So the person might get a different thesis advisor, sure. and the professor wouldn't serve on their committee, but it's like serving notice.
Mm-hmm.
And the department chair or some supervisory person has to know about it and make that, rather than have these things go on with everybody knowing but not doing anything or feeling responsible.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of assigning responsibility for reducing the opportunity for a conflict of interest.
Right, okay, thanks.
So university committee is very time consuming. It's like a crash course in education administration. You meet with the provost weekly. I would say university committee is about a half-time job.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear appeals, you run the faculty senate, you know, you set the agenda for the faculty senate and give leadership to the faculty senate. And you try to figure out ways to make the university look good to the legislature. We had a lobbyist we worked with. One of the things that came out of it sparked a change in my career in that I became interested in working with hunger prevention and doing what I could to have policies to help people not have be hungry or to have food security, we call it.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that happened is because our lobbyists discovered that the state legislature was having legislative council studies on various topics. You know, one could be water quality, one could be farmland preservation, there could be a bunch of them, but one of the topics was hunger. And the lobbyist was making the point, you know, university faculty are sitting on their hands and not helping these committees by giving them technical backup on these subjects.
Mm.
And I said, well, I could help with hunger, realizing I probably had a lot to learn about hunger. But anyway, so I served on a legislative study council committee for a couple of years and made very valuable contacts, got immersed in the topic, and then started doing research in it and working with it.
Mm.
So, you know, these things spin off.
Sure.
When you get these opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
I also ran for and was elected to the Committee on Faculty Rights and Responsibilities and was chair of that committee. And that's the committee where people who have been had discipline mm-hmm. Taken against them, or they could even be suspended because of their actions. That's their last court of appeal
mm-hmm.
without going to the legal system. So we actually had some high profile cases that we worked with to try to, you know, be a fair court of appeal, not representing administration, not representing the person,
mm-hmm.
but looking at the case and coming up with some decisions. So, you know, I feel like I've been fortunate to have the chance to make some contributions that were helpful, but also I got a lot out of them and probably enjoyed it as much as anything. So
that's interesting, because it seems to me a lot of those positions that you're talking about, is, and especially this last one, you're constantly dealing with problems, many of them individual people problems.
Yeah.
How were you able to separate? I mean, were you able not to take that home with you and lose sleep over it? Or
well, I guess I'm an essentially optimistic person, and I think that it's I'd like to think there are procedures in place to protect people,
mm-hmm.
and that sometimes it's a case of not.
I'm sorry.
Sometimes it's a case of not people not following procedures. Mm-hmm. Or their situation isn't understood by all sides. Sandy, it's very much like what I'm doing now. And I know, I don't know if you want to leap to the present.
Well, let's go ahead.
Right now, I'm an ombuds.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a position that was created by Bernice Durand, who's a saint as far as I'm concerned, who has, you know, lobbied for and got a position, a full-time position. And she decided it would be smart to make it for retired people job sharing, which is very unique. I mean, it's I don't think it exists anywhere else, although there are a lot of other campuses with ombuds. But these individuals are it's competitive. You apply to be one. And you job share this position where you hear people that are employed on campus who have a concern. It could be a working relationship in their department. It could be they were unfairly evaluated, they think. It could be, you know, they want to resign. They don't know how to do it gracefully. It could be an intellectual property issue. Somebody else is stealing their work. All sorts of possibilities. And you provide confidential help to them in terms of being a listener, helping them look at options. And the four of us have over 100 years of experience on this campus. We discuss the four cases with each other, but nobody else. And sort of four heads are better than one. Help work with the individual who is the primary counselor, the primary individual they're working with. And, you know, help resolve things like, why didn't I get my fair share of lab space or whatever? Sometimes we do shuttle diplomacy. Sometimes we'll interview somebody else to get somebody else's perspective on it, but always with the permission of the initial visitor. We call them visitors to avoid client, which sounds like we're their advocates. We're not their advocates. We're just trying to make sure that fair processes are followed. And we're also help people figure out what they really want to get out of their situation. So that's a situation where you have one problem after another. I mean, I guess deans have jobs like this too.
Right.
And you know, I think when I was asked how do I handle that, I think it's because I'm essentially a happy person. I have a nice home life. My two of my three children are still in Madison. And you know, so I don't. It's not my whole life. I don't just focus on that. And I usually, I would like to think often I can help. Sometimes these situations are very sad, no question. I mean, people have not had the good fortune I've had in terms of how they've landed in this place. But sometimes you can help them negotiate a path out of it that is better than where they are now, and they feel like they've gotten something good.
With your experience that you've been talking about, this is a perfect question for you, I think. Would you, how do you feel about the culture for women on this campus? Does it help or hinder women?
Well, it's a complicated question, of course. I mean, I think that I was on the gender equity committee. When I was on university committee, I did a lot of committee on women I was on. I was sort of appointed to these types of committees, started with the athletic board with Title IX. I reflect on how things have changed, and at the risk of sounding like, well, things were worse in my day. I think in a way they were worse, and in a way they were better. I mean, we found individual champions. Like I had the chair of the department who championed me. I always felt I was reasonably well mentored and protected. There were certainly things that happened to me because I was a woman. I mean, I was told to go into dietetics rather than chemistry. I was told not to go to graduate school, you know. And I didn't have daycare. I didn't have access to daycare, which would have been very helpful. But, and some of those things are corrected now. I mean, we did the whole equity, salary equity process where I, along with a lot of other women, got a pretty big raise because we weren't being paid comparably to people with other the same experience. So I think there are protections in place for women that weren't there before. But it's still a big struggle to combine a career and raising a family. And you know, you have your biological clock. You can't tamper with that a whole lot. And that strain is not going to, we can't wave our hands and have that go away.
Do you think there would be
parental leave, you know, we've done things, actually I worked on that. Parental leave is helpful. Parental leave for both parents.
Do you think there are other things that will change on campus?
I don't know. I guess I'm not visionary enough to know what they would all be. I mean, we do have spousal hires now. I think that we have to become more tolerant of all kinds of partnerships, not just man and woman, but, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that, we're getting pretty good support from the Chancellor's office and also from some of our enlightened legislators mm-hmm. on that. You know, there's always a lot of room to grow in terms of tolerance and accepting diversity and trying to think about what's best in terms of getting the best human resources to bear. I think we're doing better with department chair training and helping people understand that they have to be human resource people as well as fancy scientists if they're going to be in charge of other people.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But there's always room to grow, and there's always going to be some prejudice, and, you know, and that some of the people we see as visitors
mm-hmm.
talk to us about that. We just have to try to help them do the best with the situation they're in.
Did you see changes in your department over the 25 years you were there, or changes in your students?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Home economics, I mean, think about why I went there initially, because it was friendly and accepting to women, and even women who had three small children and could only go to school part-time, which mm-hmm. never would have been true in, you know, more departments like political science or psychology or
right.
even biochem, you know. So I think that women have been successful enough in some of these hard science areas that it sort of speaks. You'd have to be really stupid to think that you should pass a chance to get a really smart woman, because, you know, we have some very outstanding women scientists on campus now, many more than we had when I first started. So it's growing as the pool becomes bigger, because they can go through graduate school, because those opportunities become available. Hopefully we'll get more representatives of good women scientists who will then encourage other women.
Did you enjoy mentoring graduate students?
I had mixed results on that. Some of them I really liked. There's a woman who got a PhD with me who is now a member of the department,
mm-hmm.
who is still a very close friend. And she was a wonderful student, and we worked as a team in a variety of different capacities. I mean, she was, for a while, she was my employee, she was also my graduate student, and now she's my colleague. She's a full professor in the department.
Mm-hmm.
And she really is doing much of the kind of work I did when I was in the department. So that was a really good relationship. It's hard for me when people don't have a good sense of their strengths and try to do more than they're able to do and then can't succeed. I mean, because there's still hurdles. I mean, you have to take exams. I had one student who couldn't make it, and that was really hard for me
mm-hmm.
because I felt a little like I should have discouraged her earlier, because she put a lot of time into it and then she didn't succeed.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lot of master's degree students who were wonderful. There wasn't so much pressure on having them jump all these hurdles,
mm-hmm.
and they were fun to have around, and they got through and got out and did interesting things. But you were asking about, you know, what is it that really makes a difference in being successful? And I think some of it is energy. People have there's such varying levels of energy that people have. And I always was very high energy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I could get some of this stuff done where other people would just sort of throw up their hands and run out of steam, you know.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned one particular teaching responsibility when you taught on the radio.
Right.
But you must have taught after that.
Oh, yes, but not on the radio.
No, not on the radio.
They stopped doing that. I hope I wasn't the whole reason for that.
Did you enjoy teaching?
Yes, I did, and I did a lot of, I did that innovative course where we grew it
right.
to being huge numbers, but also I started several new courses, and I always taught about community nutrition and social programs like food stamps. I taught a nutrition education course, co-taught that with the home ec education department, because we needed to prepare teachers to be able to teach nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, you know, one thing I haven't talked about at all is I was very active in my professional society. I was president of it and won their Distinguished Service Award.
Oh, talk about that. What is the society?
It's called the Society for Nutrition Education.
Mm-hmm.
And I did practically everything you do with that society. I was president. I was editor of their journal. And I sort of picked that society early. And
why is that important, getting involved in society work, professional associations? Why is that important?
Well, I think that one of the most exciting things is going to the annual conferences and meeting people who are doing similar kinds of work and hearing them report their experiences, the informal networking as well as the professional contributions. As president, I ran an annual conference for almost 1,000 people.
Mm.
And, you know, that was very enlightening, mm-hmm. to be able to select the speakers and to craft the conference so people would get the most out of it and a lot of people would come.
Mm-hmm. Are you still involved?
Yes, I'm still involved in that. I'm on their journal committee and I'm on several other little committees. I'm on the nominating committee for that society.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned an award. Would you talk about that and other awards that you've received?
Well, the two awards that I've gotten that are national, one of them is the Helen Ulrich. Helen Denning Ulrich Annual Award of Excellence. And that's a one that is presented to one or two people a year by our society. And I actually got that award last year. And then in 1995, I got an award from the American Association of Family and Consumer Sciences, otherwise known as the American Home Ec Association, that's what mm-hmm. it was earlier, for my more general home economics work. And this is a national award. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've had some recognition that way, which is very nice, very mm-hmm. makes me very happy to get it.
Mm-hmm.
One thing we haven't talked about at all is my contributions to the community.
Yes, please talk about that.
And since retirement, I've become an ombud. That's one thing I talked about. But also, I volunteer at a local school, helping first graders write about what happened in school last week for their newsletter that they do every week.
What school?
Glenn Stevens School.
Uh-huh.
And I have a teacher that I work with there that I used to work with at Midvale. Okay. And she moved to Glenn Stevens, and I moved with her. And then I'm on the Dane County Food Council.
Oh, talk about that.
The Dane County Food Council is appointed by the Board of Supervisors. And we're supposed to look at ways we can improve the food system in Dane County very broadly. Mm-hmm. So that means everybody should have enough to eat. That means that we should support local farmers and food and environment. We should address environmental concerns about agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And there are 12 people on the committee. We're planning a big conference for March 26th.
For whom? Who?
For, well, I think we'll mostly get people that are interested in the topic,
uh-huh.
but anybody can come. I mean, lay public can come. Hmm. It's going to be at the Dane County Coliseum, hmm. now the Alliance Center.
Right.
And I think that, you know, we hope to have 100 to 200 people come to that. It's the second one like this we've planned.
Hmm.
And we have a bunch of projects. We're working on farmers markets throughout the county. We're working on institutions should be buying locally produced food when possible.
Mm-hmm.
We're interested in making market baskets available to low-income people that have fresh produce in them, you know, at a low
mm-hmm.
cost.
Mm-hmm.
So we have several initiatives. We work very closely with other groups like the Dane County Hunger Prevention Council and Madison.
Do you
Fit
work
City.
With REAP?
Yes, okay. We work with REAP.
Because I think I've been to a meeting where you attended, and I mean, I knew your background was in that area, but I wasn't.
Right. Well, this whole area of hunger prevention, food sustainability, you know, sustainable agriculture, community supported agriculture,
uh-huh.
belonging to these farms where you get the deliveries every week. I've been interested in this for about 10 years, and they all kind of flow together in my mind. And so being on that council is nice.
I'll bet. Yeah. I think you actually moved us right into the last couple of questions.
talking about your family today, life after work, actually.
Right.
Describe your family and how did you balance work and family? And you talked about that a little bit, particularly
right.
having a very supportive husband and teenage children that seem to be able to take
cope
any kind
on their
of
own.
Food that was put in front of them.
Right. I mean, I think it's, you know, my children were not nurtured and coddled the way my grandchildren are. And I'm sort of fascinated with the thought of, I wonder how much difference that will make. I mean, my children are just wonderful. I mean, they all have great.
What do they do and where are they?
My daughter runs the Habitat Restore in Madison.
Oh, really?
She went to Brown University, where she was born, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And she got a degree in women's studies in French, studied at the Sorbonne, very, you know, very Ivy League, fancy education, and came back to Madison and decided she really wanted to be a carpenter. So she went to MATC and got her journey carpenter credential, was a carpenter for about 8 or 9 years, had an injury, so she couldn't go on being an active carpenter, thought about her values, thought about what she wanted to do, used her insurance to carry her over while she, you know, did a lot of thinking, and decided that what she really wanted to do was work with recycling, and what she knew about was building materials. So she wanted to have some outlet for recycled building materials where people that couldn't otherwise afford them could get them.
Uh-huh.
And she came upon the fact, she didn't know this ahead of time, that Habitat for Humanity had things like this in other places. So she wrote a business plan. She convinced the local Habitat for Humanity to take this risk with her. She got some grants. And now she has a big, huge warehouse out on Cottage Grove Road and Monona Drive.
Very successful.
She made a lot of Habitat houses have been a result of that. It's a nonprofit, 501c3 nonprofit. She's the founder and director of it. She's run a national conference for 250 people from all over the country who came here because they had similar operations or were going to and wanted to learn. I think they're now like 8 in Wisconsin. She was the first. So it's been wonderful. It's been really wonderful. She attracts a lot of donations from all sorts of great merchants in town and builders who have, you know, these materials. And then people go there and they get great bargains.
Mm-hmm. And?
And she has 50 volunteers or something like
yeah.
that.
And what about the
Then
children?
I have two other children.
Uh-huh.
One of them was in the Peace Corps for 5 years in Africa. He worked for the Department of Limnology here for a while. He's always interested in water resources, and fish farming is what he did in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And he now is working on the Colorado River. And at this moment, he's in the Grand Canyon doing some sort of a scientific trip down there to look at the flow of the Colorado River and you know, issues of what happens with sedimentation when you have higher or lower flow from the dam that they release water from. And
mm-hmm.
it's all very political and controversial now.
Bad.
He works for the U.S. Geological Survey.
I see.
Mm-hmm. And then my third child is in Madison. He went to the University of Minnesota he got an engineering degree there. And then he went to Berkeley and got a master's degree in engineering. And he's worked with several startup companies in the West Coast, but now he's relocated to Madison. He's working with NimbleGen, which is a biotech firm,
mm-hmm.
Which makes DNA arrays. And he's one of the main engineers in that project, supported by Wharf and a lot of venture capital. And hopefully it'll be successful.
Great.
And he's got a wife and 3 children. So those are my grandchildren.
Those are your grandchildren. And how old are they?
Twins age 6 and an older one age 9.
Oh,
all
nice.
Boys.
Oh my gosh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
It is great.
Yeah. Well, so, now are they part of your fun and relaxation now that you're retired?
Yes, we all went to Disney World last week.
Oh boy.
That was fun.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I do more traveling with my kids now than my husband. My husband is sort of a stay at home. He doesn't
He's retired?
Really, he's retired from the math department
uh-huh.
for about 10 years, same amount of time I am. But he doesn't like travel as much as I do, and I like traveling. So I travel with the children and grandchildren.
So where have you been besides Disney World then?
A month ago I went to Belize.
Oh.
with my son and my unmarried son and daughter.
Uh-huh.
And we did sort of scuba diving. Well, I didn't do scuba. I did snorkeling. They did scuba.
Mm-hmm.
And also some treks out in the jungle.
Great.
It was fun.
And what else do you do that for fun and relaxation? I mean, you're still so involved with so many things.
Right.
Do you have a lot of time to?
I like to cook. I have dinner parties for people.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, I get all these community-supported agriculture foods. I look for, I look for locally grown foods and prepare them. I like to go out to restaurants where they do a very good job of this. When I can afford it.
What are your favorite restaurants here in Madison?
Well, I like Harvest and Lombardino's,
mm-hmm.
and L'Etoile when I feel I can afford it, and Nadia's. There's so many.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of wonderful ethnic restaurants now that I like.
Right. And so many of them support the local
farmer,
too.
Yes, and we're really promoting that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And REAP, you mentioned, is a group that has a big effort now to get local restaurants to buy more local foods.
And I should be able to say what it's research and
education action, I think, programs.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. Get that right.
Something like that.
Yep.
And what else do I do? Read.
Uh-huh.
I'm a big supporter of the public library.
Very good. Well, we've come to the end of the questions, but I don't want to turn the tape off. If there's anything that you'd like to add that we didn't cover. I mean, you've had such a varied and interesting career here that, I want to give you the chance to.
Well, I've got to say, I'm really lucky. And I think that's one reason that drives me to do what I can to help people improve their situation and what keeps me motivated and why I'm really happy I got this ombuds job.
Yeah.
And willing to talk about this because, you hear a lot of bad stories about the university. But, I think it's a really wonderful place to have been. I'm really very fortunate I landed up here. A lot of it was sort of accidental.
Mm-hmm.
That first mention by Connie Trinan and Marion Thompson of think about going to school, and then the support that I got from the dean of the home,
sure.
Although she would have had every right to have said, I don't think so, And the support I got from my professor, the chair of the Department of Nutrition, all of these experiences were fine. And there have been some bumps in the road. I mean, the administration one with extension was a bump in the road. It really was devastating to me because
mm-hmm.
I'm not used to failing at something. But, I can look back on it and see why that happened. And it wasn't all my fault. And get beyond it and try to do something productive. And so, I just feel like I've been extremely fortunate. I'm glad I've had the opportunity to talk about it.
Yeah. Well, it's obvious that the university was very fortunate, too. So thank you very much. It was an excellent interview. Really appreciate it.